from WBUR in Boston. I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. There will be a football game tomorrow, or so I'm told, ahead on Only a Game, a preview of Super Bowl XLII and the story of a Phoenix-area monastery taking in thrifty witnesses to the spectacle. And for fans of gentle truths obscured by Super Bowl carnage and excess, we offer Super Bowl Haiku XIV.
Yes, he's coming! That hunky McFabulous. Hide all your models!
Also ahead, the University of Maryland competitive cheerleading squad goes up against no one.
It's a big mess. You know, what's the thrill of going to a competition and bringing home a first-place trophy when you are the only team in that division?
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Tomorrow, the New York Giants and the New England Patriots will play a game of football in Arizona. Everyone in the world will be watching except for a small angry man in Kathmandu whose satellite dish has filled up with snow blown over in the wind and toppled down the mountain. Joining me now from Arizona to discuss the most significant single event in the history of human competition is Mike Reese, who writes about football for the Boston Globe. Mike, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Hype aside, and we would need a very large bulldozer to move the hype aside, tomorrow's entertainment is a football game, and this week the New York Giants have sounded confident about the outcome of that game, or have they just been whistling to keep their spirits up?
Oh, they've been confident. Two things that caught my eye. One was them arriving in Arizona all wearing black, and the idea that they were coming to a funeral to bury the Patriots. So that was the first thing. And the second thing was a prediction made by one of their top players, Plaxico Burress, who said 23-17, that'll be the final score. And, of course, he didn't have to say who he thought was going to win.
Well, in order for them to score 23 or more points, Eli Manning is going to have a good day. He's the quarterback for the Giants. The label on him has been, quote, inconsistent, end quote. Maybe he's consistent, at least through these playoffs, but the Super Bowl is different. Does inconsistency catch up with him?
That is the big question, which Eli Manning will show up. He had 20 interceptions in the regular season. That's too high for a starting quarterback. But in the Giants' three playoff wins, no interceptions, and you know how important turnovers are in any football game. So really, I don't think anyone has the answer to the question. I just think that analysts who are sort of studied this game realize it's probably one of the top questions entering this game.
Tell me a little bit about some of the other Giants who may figure prominently in this game.
Sure. Well, we mentioned Plaxico Burress, the 6'5" wide receiver who will have a height mismatch over some smaller New England cornerbacks, Asante Samuel and Ellis Hobbs, both in the 5'10 range. And so he's a player that hurt the Patriots the last time they met. And I think you also want to look at offensively their running back tandem of Brandon Jacobs and Ahmad Bradshaw. Those two players, they're tough for defenses because they're so different. Jacobs is a bigger back who can break tackles and run over you, while Bradshaw, who's a rookie, is a smaller, quicker back who will run by you. So it's sort of an effective changeup. And defensively, I just mentioned a couple of players who are very good at rushing the passer, OCU Menorah, Michael Strahan, and Justin Tuck. The Giants had 53 quarterback sacks, an NFL high in the regular season, and those three players sort of lead the charge.
All right, we can't ignore the Patriots forever, so here goes. Tom Brady has earned a reputation as one of the best clutch quarterbacks in the history of the game. Will he be true to form tomorrow?
I think he'll be true to form, and I think when he first steps out on the field to take his first snap, I think a lot of eyes will be on his right ankle. It's been a story leading up to the game that he had the mild high ankle sprain suffered in that AFC Championship game, and I think people are curious how much it'll affect his performance. Tom Brady, what makes him so efficient efficient and excellent is that in the big moments, the game slows down for him. He's able to keep his composure and make the right decisions and avoid those critical mistakes. And there's really no reason to think that the game will be any different than what we've seen in the past.
The Patriots enjoyed one of the more exceptional starts in NFL history this season, and even though they won all their games, there really has seemed to be some fading as the season has gone on. That wasn't part of Coach Bill Belichick's master plan, was it?
Far from it. And one of the things that Bill Belichick often talks about is you want to be playing your best football at the end of the season. And really, that hasn't been the case for the Patriots. You might actually argue and say, hey, it's the Giants that are playing better football towards the end of the season. And you look for reasons why. And I think part of it was that, you know, the Patriots were getting every team's best shot because every team wanted to be the one to knock the Patriots off that undefeated season track there. And I think the other part is teams caught up to them a little bit. The Patriots have the market on some pretty good ideas, some pretty good strategy. And I think early in the year, teams were still figuring out what they were doing. And as the year progresses, there's more videotape to process. And I think teams caught up to them a little bit.
Mike, I know that you are working at your fourth Super Bowl, and it seems like each time the Super Bowl story gets done to death in the week or two leading up to the game itself. But have you come across any obscure subplots or underreported stories that would surprise, delight, interest, amaze our listeners?
How about the game itself? I mean, that's...
Oh, come on!
That to me seems underreported. I have to tell you the truth. I mean, maybe I need to play along more, but I just feel like, you know, the actual game itself gets overlooked by the show that the Super Bowl has become.
Well, it is, after all, the Super Bowl, but it is, after all, also a football game, so I can't let you go without asking for your prediction, and you have been talking about the Giants as if it's not just going to be happy to be there, Giants.
No, I do. I think the Giants, if they can get some pressure on Tom Brady, and that has been their MO, I think they have a chance to win the game. But I do think in the end that we're looking at one of the greatest teams, if not the greatest team, you know, in the salary cap era from that early 90s on here. And I can't pick against the Patriots at this point. So I'm going to pick them to win the game. But I do think the Giants will put up a good fight.
Well, if they do win, that's enough, right? You and your colleagues will crown them one of the very best teams ever.
Yeah, I would say so. I don't think they need to win by 10, 20, 30. 3 points will do, and as we've seen from the Patriots in past Super Bowls, 3 points is usually what the margin is.
Mike Reese covers the NFL for the Boston Globe, and he joined me on the line from Arizona. Mike, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Everything is bigger at the Super Bowl, especially the cost of attending it. A single ticket for tomorrow's Super Bowl in Glendale, Arizona, can run as much as $20,000. It's nearly impossible to find a hotel room in the Phoenix area for less than $500 a night. But a handful of relatively thrifty fans have found what might be the best deal in the Valley of the Sun, and it's just 10 miles south of the University of Phoenix Stadium. From Phoenix, Only a Game's Gabe O'Connor reports.
Ice cream trucks make their evening rounds near Our Lady of Guadalupe Monastery. Surrounded by adobe walls, the outside grounds are an idyllic landscape with palm and citrus trees shading a newly swept sitting area and a relief of Our Lady of Guadalupe, adorned with Christmas lights. Football fans suffering from super sticker shock have found refuge here, thanks to rates of only $250 a night for two people. The monastery has offered spiritual retreats for all of its 9 years, but a recent land purchase has left it in debt. Super Bowl 42 presented an opportunity to pay off the mortgage, says Our Lady of Guadalupe Prioress, Sister Linda Campbell.
When people started talking about renting their homes, we thought that it would be a good idea to rent rooms that we use for retreat, because we had this big fundraising piece going on to pay for the land that we just purchased. So we looked at it as another fundraiser.
For those who view Super Bowl 42 as just another opportunity to indulge in the usual activities, well, there's a catch. There's no drinking or smoking on the premises. That's almost sacrilege on Super Bowl weekend, but Sister Linda says she's heard no complaints.
Actually, the reaction has been, well, that's why I'm coming, because I want something a little quieter. I'm not into the alcohol or the smoking, and so, and several people said, well, I'm bringing my son, and I'd rather he not be around that.
Our Lady of Guadalupe is completely booked this weekend. All 10 rooms are filled with fans of each Super Bowl combatant, and Sister Linda insists they all get along.
That's right. Well, our house is divided up between Patriots and Giants, too, so it's not going to be any different than the rest of the monastery. So, but hopefully we'll all get along, and we're just going to have a good game and a good time.
The idea at first was to rent monastery rooms to members of the sports media. A large flat-screen TV was installed in the meeting room, and the building was rigged for wireless internet. Though the media never came to stay, they have come to visit. The monastery story has attracted local reporters, the New York Times, and public radio interlopers like me. This has surprised Sister Linda.
I had no idea. I didn't expect to have this amount of media people to talk to or ask questions or do stories on us. It just came totally out of the blue for me.
Well, I can safely say, being a member of the sports media, that it's much better to have the sports media visit than to actually have them stay.
Okay. All right. Well, we thought we could do some pretty good hospitality for him, but maybe what you have to say is true.
During my tour of the building, I asked Sister Linda if she thinks the excess of the Super Bowl creates a strange contrast to the monastic lifestyle.
You know, I grew up with sports. I have four brothers, and between my four brothers and my dad, if my sister and my mom and I weren't interested in sports, we were out of luck on the weekends. Because I grew up in Southern Indiana, and basketball and baseball are really important pieces, and I really do like football. I don't know of any convent in the country that doesn't have sisters who are sports fans.
Sister Linda shows me the bedrooms, each named after a saint. Most sleep three or more. The furniture is secondhand. There are no TVs or telephones, but every room has a homey charm, and that's due in large part to volunteers like Bibi Hernandez.
We've been cleaning up all the bedrooms, making sure they're spick and span with clean towels and little goodies on the pillows and little gifties for everybody, and then all the information they need to check out the valley.
Bibi and a couple of volunteers are busy in the kitchen getting things ready for the first guests to arrive tonight. It's a large kitchen with two refrigerators and plenty of room for guests to bring their own food, which the monastery will prepare on request. And it wouldn't be the Super Bowl without the complimentary drinks.
What we did was we put juices and soft drinks and waters in the refrigerator. And we're just going to use the honor system. They can donate money for the extra drinks if they want. And we just wanted to be able to have the feel of home.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow, the honor system during Super Bowl week.
Is that a new entity?
It's once again, it's a big contradiction.
It's our monastery minibar.
As I leave the monastery, a peacock idly pecks at something on the impeccably maintained lawn. Sister Linda says he arrived here last year and decided to stay. Perhaps he knows something the people who pay $1,000 a night at the nearby motels don't. For Only a Game, I'm Gabe O'Connor in Phoenix, Arizona.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Wim Hof says he is a tantric master. Hof maintains that he has earned that designation by learning how to control his body temperature, among other variables, by means of tantric meditation. Last weekend, Mr. Hof demonstrated his talent by breaking his own world record for time spent engulfed in ice. On a Manhattan street corner, Mr. Hof stood in a clear container filled with ice for 1 hour and 12 minutes. Presumably, the people who walked past that street corner set a record for number of individuals pretending not to notice that anything out of the ordinary was transpiring, since this did happen in New York. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Maryland's cheerleaders win again. But first, Tiger Woods won last weekend's Buick Open in San Diego by about 117 strokes. No surprise there. But some of the golfers who failed to appear in Tiger's rearview mirror were surprised by the potential ramifications and consequences of the drug testing program that will soon be imposed on PGA golfers. The season's first tournament gave Tour Commissioner Tim Fincham the opportunity to address about 100 players regarding the new policy. Joining me now is Doug Ferguson, who writes about golf for the Associated Press and was at the Buick Open. Mr. Ferguson, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
Tell me, what is this new policy?
Policy starts in July. It's basically a drug testing program. I think golf was starting to feel pressure from other sports. You know, for years they resisted this, asking first, can you identify a drug that's actually going to help somebody? And I'm not sure they have the answer to that, frankly. But there was a lot of pressure from from the British media for one, and other golfing organizations that played worldwide and were subject to other governments, et cetera, and it was time to jump in. So the first 6 months of the year is known as the education program, and they got quite an education last week at Torrey Pines.
Well, all right, you've already made the point that there may not be an easily identifiable drug that would help golfers. Olympic athletes, professional bicyclists, players in the NBA, the NFL, Major League Baseball, they're all tested for banned performance-enhancing drugs. What argument besides, hey, what's going to help us, do some of the golfers make that they shouldn't be tested?
I think one of the biggest fears, I guess, that came out of the meeting was what they kept referring to as the mistake. The concern was that it wasn't anything that they might be doing purposely to cheat, basically, Bill, mm-hmm. but that something would turn up in their system that's on the list and they're labeled a cheater.
So nose spray, cold medicine, stuff that they always assumed they could take if they needed to, they might have to be a lot more careful about.
Yeah, I mean, the one that got a lot of attention was the Vicks nasal spray or whatever the exact term was. But, you know, for others who have been taking a protein shake, eating an energy bar, and, you know, then you've got to know everything that's going into your body. They've never had to worry about that before.
According to an article you recently wrote, perhaps the most dramatic response to the drug testing policy came from Frank Licklider, who was especially upset that a drug tester might follow him home. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Frank was just maybe the most vocal on the record, we might be able to say, Bill. Frank's like that. He's very heavy into his constitutional rights, his membership in the NRA. Frank found that to be somewhat of an invasion of privacy and took issue to it. And I'm not sure how much more we can go with that.
Well, I think you better go the whole way, because he took issue in a rather dramatic way, didn't he?
He did. I think, when they mentioned that someone indeed could come to your house, I think Frank's first comment was, not without a warrant, or something along those lines. I may have left out a word or two. And when I talked to him after his round earlier, he said that anyone who comes onto my property is not going to leave without a bullet somewhere on his body, and you can fill in the blanks where.
I think our listeners will have no trouble filling in the blanks. I understand that George O'Grady, the European Tour chief, suggested that it would save time and money if the authorities limited their testing to Tiger Woods. Would Tiger's colleagues accept that strategy?
You know, I asked a couple of them, and a lot of them didn't mind. And frankly, you know, I set George up on that quote back at the President's Cup last year when the idea was, have you thought about the idea of maybe testing Tiger, and if he doesn't come back positive, just abandon the program? And that's when George said, if he's clean, what does it matter what the rest of them are on?
Yeah,
and I think
exactly.
A lot of them, and it goes back to what I mentioned earlier, Bill, that identifying a drug that's actually going to enhance their performance or help them win, I really don't know what's out there. Even if these guys were doing something, it obviously ain't helping them beat Tiger.
Well, no, but I guess the argument for the sake of argument would be a bigger, stronger guy could hit the ball further. He gets an advantage off the tee. He gets an advantage with his long irons. Obviously, steroids isn't going to help you putt very much.
Right, and that's kind of the sticking point with a lot of players who are kind of resisting this or didn't like it in the first place. We have, you know, numerous examples of players who have actually finished first on PGA Tour in driving distance, and they didn't even keep their card for the year. distance is so over... I don't want to say it's overrated, because
right.
It's helpful, because Nicklaus was long, and Palmer was long, and Tiger's long, and Phil Mickelson, and power is always an advantage. But once you hit it out there, there's so much other skill involved that some people are having a hard time understanding where drugs would help you there.
Beyond all that, golf has traditionally been a sport in which players have been expected to call penalties on themselves. So do the current pros feel as if drug testing will change the way they think of themselves and each other?
I don't think so, but it's an interesting point, and one that Commissioner Fincham brought up years ago. At first I thought it was goofy, where he said the first step we would take is have a drug policy, and here's your list of banned drugs or substances and methods and what have you. And these are the rules, and you're expected to abide by those rules just the same way that you don't kick a ball out from under a tree or put a four down when you made a five or what have you. I think that's probably being a little bit naive, but you know, Paul Azinger made it, I thought, a fairly interesting point in conversation that was if you're going to have someone accompanying you into the restroom as you pee into the cup, if that's what golf has come to, why aren't you sending a rules official out with every single player to make sure that he's not moving his ball around in the rough or mm-hmm. under a tree or what have you?
It really is the only sport in which you could make that argument, because I'm thinking, you know, baseball, for example, hey, if you can get away with something that gives you an edge, you do it. Football, my goodness, they say they could call a penalty on every play if the officials wanted to do it. So, but golf has that tradition, you know. I'm not going to cheat. I'm going to call myself if my ball moves a little bit in the rough.
Yeah, and we had that example already this year. It was kind of funny, actually, where Scott Replank was in the fairway kind of on an upslope, and the wind was blowing a million miles an hour at him, and he thought his ball might have moved, and he called an official over and replayed the whole incident. And he was assessed a penalty stroke.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I just don't see that happening in the NBA when a guy's driving the lane and says, you know what, I may not have had my feet set there.
Once the new testing program is implemented, do you anticipate that we'll learn that golfers have been using anything to enhance their performances?
I think the answer was probably would have been no, would not have expected it, but frankly, I don't know, and I think that's what golf is afraid of. Is if somebody who was taking, you know, a nutrient shake didn't look at the label carefully, bought it over the counter, whatever the case may be, and he gets popped. I mean, how many times have you seen a guy say, oh, yeah, I tested positive here, but I don't know how that happened. And, mm-hmm. yeah, sure you didn't know how it happened. I think they're worried about falling under that same skepticism. I really don't know. I think generically we think of drug testing as steroids, you know, building yourself up. And I think for that, again, I would be hard-pressed to think someone's doing it, but let's not be too naive here. I mean, there's a lot of kids who have grown up in this culture of seeing baseball players or football players or track and field athletes taking drugs. They're in the gym. They see how fit these guys are getting these days, and I need to get fit, and maybe this will help me. There you go.
AP writer Doug Ferguson has been talking to professional golfers about the new PGA drug testing policy. Doug, thank you very much for speaking with me.
No problem, Bill. Enjoy it.
Just over 4 years ago, the University of Maryland began its varsity cheerleading program. At the time, the Terrapin Tumblers, Tuckers, and TikTokers had every reason to believe that they'd soon go up against some serious intercollegiate competition. But as Sarah Richards reports, that has not been the case.
A long blue tumbling mat is laid out on the floor at the Baltimore Convention Center. Young women speed down the mat and flip hands over feet. They're members of the University of Maryland's competitive cheerleading team. This is the first varsity competitive cheerleading team in the country. They don't cheer at basketball games like regular cheerleaders do. Instead, all they do is participate in cheerleading contests. Today, it's the Charm City dress rehearsal. Jarnell Bonds is Maryland's head coach. She says competitive cheerleading is a natural evolution from traditional cheerleading.
Everyone's been to some type of basketball or football game and seen cheerleaders on the sideline doing, let's say, stunts or doing tumbling or doing a dance to the music with the band. So what happened is what cheerleaders were doing on the sideline became so entertaining that they developed competitions to go against each other with those same skills.
The biggest competition takes place in April in Daytona. Still, most cheerleading teams stick to waving pom-poms at their school's games. They do compete at cheerleading competitions, but only once or twice a year. That means at today's dress rehearsal, Maryland's varsity team has no one to compete against. Angela Fisher is the team's assistant coach.
It's kind of like we're judging against ourselves. We try to improve upon that score each time, or within ourselves, hitting everything, and not feeling like we could have done better. So almost it feels like I feel like it's more pressure on the girls because there's no one there chasing them.
Maryland's team takes the stage. The women flip, fly, and shake their way through a 2.5-minute performance. Next fall, they'll be joined by the University of Oregon, which recently announced it was adding varsity competitive cheerleading. But until then, Maryland is alone in this new intercollegiate sport. At a practice a few weeks later, team captain Laura Kiriako says she didn't think that 4 years on, she'd still be waiting for another school to add a competitive cheerleading team.
I mean, for myself, I expected, you know, by the time I was a senior to have all kinds of competitive cheerleading programs. It takes time because you have to change the way people view cheerleading. It's more of an issue, I guess, with people outside of the program because they go and they don't, and, you know, maybe you'll have friends come and they don't understand, you know, why are there all these little girls here? You know, I don't understand. Are you competing against these little girls?
It's hard to miss the little girls. They're competing in the Ankle Biters, Mighty Mites, and Minis divisions. And they're everywhere, moving around in packs, sparkles in their hair trailing them like contrails of planes. But most of all, they watch the Maryland team, the oldest, most experienced group here.
What did they do?
They scream and clap when Maryland performs. With this kind of fan base, why isn't there more support for competitive cheerleading events at the college level?
And, of course, this has been a topic of conversation the past couple of years.
Bill Boggs is the senior vice president of educational alliances at Varsity Brands, the company that sells clothes, trains cheerleaders, and even runs competitions. Boggs doesn't think competitive cheerleading is even cheerleading. He says most university coaches he talks to don't want competitive cheerleading teams.
They do not have the coaching, they do not have the funding. And more importantly, they do not have the desire. The mass majority of them will say, well, no, we don't want that. That's what we're here for. That's what we do. And then if we have an opportunity for our team to compete once a year, well, great. You know, that's an added incentive, an added bonus for our kids to participate in once all the other things have been accomplished for our schools.
But there's another reason there aren't more competitive teams. And it has to do with the Title IX federal gender equality law. In order for a school to field a varsity cheerleading squad, its primary purpose must be competition, not cheering. Kathy Worthington is Maryland's Senior Associate Athletics Director.
What a lot of schools would like to do is take their current spirit squad, combine them, and have a combined spirit squad and competitive cheer team, which we think is okay, and we've asked the OCR for direction on that. What the OCR has been hesitant is to tell people what's primary. You know, does primary mean 51% of your team's time is spent in competition?
The OCR is the Office of Civil Rights, which provides guidance on Title IX. But Bill Boggs doesn't think it matters. He doesn't think more colleges and universities will sign up for the sport anytime soon.
It's a big mess. You know, what's the thrill of going to a competition and bringing home a first place trophy when you are the only team in that division? And by the way, you just spent, you know, $20,000 to go compete with yourself.
And now your grand champion is the University of Maryland competitive.
Back at the competition, Maryland finishes first in its division and receives a trophy. The women are happy, but not surprised. They know there's a lot more work to be done before other schools can provide an opponent other than themselves. For Only a Game, I'm Sarah Richards in Baltimore.
Y'all ready for this?
You're listening to Only a Game. Last week's program began with my conversation with Bonnie D. Ford, who was in Melbourne for the Australian Open. This delighted Sam Clark, who hears Only a Game via Vermont Public Radio. Thanks for covering tennis, he wrote. More interesting than lots of stuff right now. Good Lord, was the man unaware that at the time the Super Bowl was a mere 8 days away? From Harrisonburg, Virginia, Wendolyn C. Turley, who hears the program on WMRA, wrote to say she thinks the athletes who compete in the Winter X Games are, quote, poetry in motion. She suggested we should visit with them in Aspen, but the 12th annual Winter X Games only ran from January 24th to the 27th. Short poem, sort of like a haiku. Marcia Roby, who hears the program on New Hampshire Public Radio, was moved by the story on last week's show about powerlifter Anderson Wise, who was born with spina bifida. Really wonderful, she wrote. What an inspiring guy and family. Thanks. She also enjoyed my conversation with Baylor women's basketball coach Kim Mulkey. A Pennsylvania listener identifying him or herself as DT didn't feel that way, opining that the Mulkey interview was way too long. DT spelled way with six A's and three Y's, which strikes me as way too many. In my conversation with Charlie Pierce last week, I suggested that there are two kinds of people in the world, those who can stand a January weekend without football and those who watch the Senior Bowl. Charlie cleverly countered by maintaining that the world is divided into people who think the world is divided into two kinds of people and smart people. This provoked Lee Swanson, who hears the program on KPBS in San Diego, to write, "Charlie Pierce showed remarkable candor. How long will it take him to realize that by making that statement, he was putting himself in the former group and not the latter?" Bob Yarber, another KPBS listener, wrote to correct my assertion that no coach of a men's basketball team had more victories than Bob Knight. Harry Statham of McKendree College in Illinois has over 950 wins and is still counting, Mr. Yarber wrote, and he's right, I should have stipulated Division I coaches. If you have a correction, a pat on the back, or a story suggestion, get in touch with us through our website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Our address is Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Charles River Apparel, introducing Charles River Sport, a new line of wicking polos and tees in a variety of team colors, charlesriverapparel.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Perhaps Rich Rodriguez, the former coach of the football team at the University of West Virginia, thought that people would just forget that in December he shredded various team-related documents and then skipped out on the West Virginia job to take over the football program at the University of Michigan. Not so. Tonight, the Wheeling Nailers, a minor league hockey team, will hold Shred Rich Rodriguez Night. Fans who bring pictures of the departed coach or articles about him will be invited to shred them at the rink. And fans wearing Ohio State jerseys will get discounts on their tickets since Ohio State is Michigan's most significant rival. Fans wearing University of Michigan apparel will be charged double for their seats. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, our annual poetic take on the Super Bowl, the event which Charlie Pierce is about to tell us is, well, I'll let that be a surprise as he and I ease into our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Without further ado, your pronouncement regarding the worthiness of the big game, please.
The Super Bowl is good.
There we go. Just exactly what I hoped you would say. You said last week that the Patriots would brush the Giants aside without too much trouble. You promised that you would say that again this week.
The Patriots will brush the Giants aside without too much trouble. 38-10.
Okay, well, that's a little bit different from Plaxico Burress's prediction, which I think
I try not to ever take seriously the prediction of men named after cleaning products.
Did you like the way Brady responded to Burress's prediction? By the way, Burress said it's going to be, 17 points the Patriots would score. They'd lose 23-17.
Yeah. He asked if Plaxico was going to be playing defense, which normally he doesn't get quite that giddy in a pregame warm-up, so that makes me feel that the Patriots have seen something on, let us hope, official game films that they can really exploit.
Yeah.
I mean, the Patriots have been kind of loose for the Patriots. Even Coach Belichick showing up in the press conference with the Rutgers lacrosse shirt and stuff. I mean, this is giddiness for Coach Hoodie. I think the Patriots are feeling very, very confident right now.
How would you like to have had the job of the guy who ran the 500,000 computer simulations of tomorrow's game?
That's called an afternoon in the lives of most middle schoolers, isn't it? 500 individual games?
500,000!
Yeah, the Patriots won 79% of them, though. And apparently this Sports Sims in Ohio has a 15-5 record picking a Super Bowl winner. So both the computers and me agree. Of course, they might be running me now. Who knows? That's what they'd like you to believe.
Paul. That's what I hear. The Right Honorable Arlen Specter, Republican, Pennsylvania, this week compared the NFL's destruction of the so-called Spygate tapes to the CIA's destruction of tapes and records. I have to speak quietly.
It's the Templars. It's the Freemasons. Let me see if I have this straight. Over the great arc of his career, Arlen Specter, former Warren Commission counsel, doesn't believe in a conspiracy behind the John F. Kennedy assassination, but does believe in some sort of conspiracy behind the NFL's destruction of videotapes of the football game it got from the New England Patriots. Mm. Are we getting just a little bit over the hill here, Senator Specter? In the first place, destroying the tapes never made any sense, and it makes even less sense when Roger Goodell explains it, because if there's nothing on the tapes that's against league rules, why not just give them back to the Patriots?
They could reuse them.
Yeah, and if there is, why don't we know about it? All of that having been said, the Senate of the United States really has more important things to do than this. They have to investigate steroids in baseball.
That's an excellent point. The goodness and the enormity of the Super Bowl notwithstanding, there are a few other sports matters for us to discuss. Jason Kidd no longer wants to be a New Jersey Net. Where do you suppose he'll play next?
Well, he's not going to go to the Mavericks anytime soon, because the Avery Johnson, the coach of the Mavericks, has pretty much said that they're not involved in it. Now, this could all be, you know, huffing and blowing the way people do as the trade is being made in the back room. You know, Jason Kidd's going to wind up somewhere, as is Sam Cassell, I think, and I wouldn't be surprised if one of them wound up here.
We now have a complete list of the 2008 NBA All-Stars. Charlie, who is this L. James?
Well, that's the young man from Cleveland who's been making a bit of a sensation in the league this year. you know, you've got Chris Paul and David West, two guys from the New Orleans team, to play for the game in New Orleans, which I think is a terrific thing. I really hope this goes off well, because there was all kinds of really icky and rancid speculation about putting a game in New Orleans, but I really do hope it goes off well.
NBA China announced this week that it will design and run the building that will house the 2008 Olympic basketball action. How will Chinese basketball fans react to T-shirt cannons, kiss cams, and laser shows? Are they ready for this?
I don't know, actually. I certainly hope that some American forms of game presentation don't make it over the pond.
Kansas State University broke a losing streak of 24 years this week. The players at the University of Kansas were no doubt surprised to lose to the Wildcats at home for the first time in a quarter of a century. Did that result surprise you as well?
It did, actually, because I think Kansas is the best team in the country, and more to the point, they're one of the few teams in the top five I've actually seen play when they came over here and dismantled Boston College. Michael Beasley, the freshman who will be in the NBA next year, got 25. Kansas State is not a bad club right now, and this is just, as has been pointed out, Michael Beasley, the freshman, wasn't even alive the last time Kansas State beat Kansas in their own place.
Were you happy to learn this week that we no longer have to worry that there is no pro golfer capable of challenging Tiger Woods for supremacy on the tour?
Well, that actually lasted a day, Bill, and then Ian Poulter said he was misquoted by the tabloid hacks at Golf World UK.
Mm-hmm.
He apparently said that he respects every professional golfer, and when he plays to his full potential, it will just be him and Tiger. Why do people keep doing this? Don't make him mad. Did you watch the Buick Open last week? He's going to win every tournament this year.
This week, the organizers of the French Open tennis tournament filed a lawsuit aimed at preventing online gambling operations from offering clients the opportunity to bet on the tournament. Interesting ploy. Can it work?
I think it's an interesting ploy. Obviously, they're dealing with the Davidenko-Arguello match, you know, last year that caused all the foo-for-ah about online betting. I just don't know how you would enforce it. I mean, most of these guys are, people sitting in their grandmother's basements in Aruba, aren't they? I mean, how are you going to track them all down? I think this is one of those noble efforts that the internet has rendered sort of futile.
Major League Baseball's umpires expressed outrage about background checks to which they have been subjected. What specific problems do the umps have with the way they're being investigated?
Well, apparently, a couple of umpires who live in northern Kentucky found out their neighbors were being asked if the two umpires were members of the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, I keep saying this when everybody proposes, you know, drug testing is this panacea. You create a climate in which this stuff is not only possible, it's inevitable. If you agree with the argument that because you take a paycheck, the company can do pretty much anything it wants to you, this is what you get. And now the umpires are upset. It's a little late.
In line with our policy to recognize winners of competitions of all sorts, Charlie, would you do the honors on behalf of intrepid UPS driver Sean Finnis?
Yeah, well, as you know, that UPS people tend to wear shorts in the summertime. And apparently four workers in Calgary that work for UPS made a bet in 1996, each chipping in $100, who would wear the shorts the longest. And the winner was 38-year-old Sean Finnis, who collected $400 in the past week. And Monday, he went out to work in shorts when the wind chill was 48 below zero. I admire Sean Finnis, but more than that, I admire his knees.
And finally, Charlie, 395 Croatians who gathered recently dressed as Smurfs are terribly disappointed. Why is that?
You know, you go to downtown Komen, you paint yourself blue, you put on the funny hat, everybody has a great time, you make sure the count's right, you take the picture, and you find out that an English group in Warwick has already beaten you to the record.
More Smurfs.
What's next?
In Warwick.
What can you possibly do to get in the Guinness Book of World Record once you've painted yourself blue? Although I will guarantee you that Sean Finnis, the UPS driver in Calgary, has been blue a lot longer than these people have.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Get you. I'll get all of you if it's the last thing I ever do.
La, 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 la. Now you know the two. You'll be smurfing soon.
I didn't grab my milk.
Okay. One of the first things I noticed when I visited the Dale Street Elementary School in Medfield, Massachusetts this week was a bass fiddle leaning against the wall near the principal's office. I asked idly if any of the youngsters could play it. Enter Nick Fragola, who not only plays the bass but knows what a haiku is.
Yeah, it's poems where the first line is 5 syllables, the second line is 7. The third line is 5.
Nick's grasp of the haiku form was crucial because Only a Game producer Karen Given and I were visiting the Medfield School in search of Super Bowl haiku. We'd heard that visiting poet Andrew Green of Potato Hill Poetry had been encouraging fourth graders at the Dale Street School to write some of them.
So you can do a little 5-7-5 for us? You know, a little bum 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 bum.
Eat your heart out, Jack Kerouac.
Students in grade 4, please go to the conference room. Students in grade 4, please bring a pencil. Thank you.
Go grab a seat, sit down anywhere, and we'll get your poems to you.
As he handed his students their poems, Andrew Green talked about how he'd been helping them to see poetry in the broadest possible terms.
Some kids had some of the ideas that poetry was about subjects that they weren't interested in.
Necessarily about flowers and springtime,
exactly.
And
yes,
love.
Yes, falling in love, but the fact that poems can be about the ordinariness of everyday lives and what they encounter in their classroom, in the lunch line at school.
Of course, there's nothing ordinary about the Super Bowl.
That's true, but I think what we'll find in these haiku is that some of the kids have discovered some of the ordinariness of the extraordinary.
Andrew went on to demonstrate how haiku could encourage a poet to get to the essence of a subject and offered as an example the efforts of fourth grader Jen Cochran.
One game at a time, they ate all the humble pie to get to perfect.
Representative of the students who are genuinely enthusiastic about the big game is Brian Carabas.
Bud Lights and popcorn, priceless pep talks with Peyton, I am excited.
Nice recognition of the alliteration in the ad there, don't you think? And if you're not entirely thrilled that a fourth grader begins his poem by naming a brand of beer, hey, it's Super Bowl weekend in America. He's gotten a message. Lighten up. Anyway, Abby Sear liked the idea of food imagery, too.
Fizzle, crackle, pop. Soda, dipping chips, popcorn. Sweet, salt, buttery.
Some of the students, among them Kevin McCordick, chose to focus on what might happen on the field rather than on the couch or the Barca lounger. Kevin was aware that the New York Giants had advanced to the Super Bowl courtesy of a field goal by Lawrence Tynes, who had missed a couple of kicks before hitting the one that counted.
Tynes misses again. The crowd is going crazy. Just another win.
And then there were the fourth graders who were less thrilled by the prospect of the Super Bowl. Fourth graders who'd just as soon have been writing haiku about butterflies in spring or snowflakes in winter. Fourth graders like Kelly Kennedy and Zoe Smith.
I won't be watching, but my dad will be watching. I won't be watching.
Sunday afternoon, watching boring football game. I would rather read.
The thing I like about that is it sounds like you're required to watch the football game.
Yeah, because what my mom and dad say, go to bed or watch the game when it's getting late. So I just read.
Some of the fourth graders were so excited about reading their haiku into a microphone that they decided to write more. An especially prolific poet named Megan found her subject in our visit.
Camera snapping, click. A mic pointing at who? You, reading your haiku.
Kids reading and kids writing poetry for the fun of it? There may be hope for this battered land after all. In any case, now it's time to call upon the talents of the Only a Game Hut Hut Haiku players for the edition of Super Bowl Haiku that we like to call XIV.
Catch. Haiku season blooms. Cactus flower like a big cactus flower.
Brett Favre sits sadder than Peyton Manning, who has a super frère.
Simpson distracted. Giselle didn't. Tom Brady indistractable.
Girly man boot limp. Flowers. Giselle's little dog. He wins anyway.
Eighteen is nothing.
19 would be everything.
18 is nothing.
Decades of big games have taught us humbly hope for a game worth watching.
Giants almost won. Last time, Giants barely lost.
Yeah, so take the points.
What's this yellow line? It was here, now over there. Who is moving it?
Ground control. Major.
Roger, your brilliance. Command.
Throw touchdown passes.
Illegal filming, assault charge, drug suspension.
We're all patriots.
Runs bounce men sideways. Bruise them. Short passes here, there.
Itch like mosquitoes. Brady, protect it. Looks. Looks left, pumps twice, and looks right.
Brady just looks great.
Brady just looks great.
Brady just looks great.
Where giants once roamed, where men trembled before them, their lunch is eaten.
Super Bowl? Rubbish. Dolphins, Giants in London.
That's super. Right, lads?
Happy day. Except when Super Bowl is empty. Still February.
Silly coach screaming. Remember, his head explodes. Tom Coughlin's that guy.
Patriots on top, all the other teams below. A great pyramid.
And so, as the sun either rises, sets, or blazes mercilessly down on Giza, depending on what time it is in Egypt as you listen to this, the 14th annual edition of Super Bowl Haiku, our most international version yet, has once again prepared the way for the football game that will transpire tomorrow. I hope you enjoyed it, and may we get a game that holds our attention right through that last soggy Dorito. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Parati. Special thanks this week to Andrew Green of Potato Hill Poetry and to the Only a Game Hut Hut Haiku players, Anna Benstead, Walter Dixon, George Hicks, Ted O'Brien, and Rookie of the Year, Claudine Ebade. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Maryland cheerleading or Medfield Haiku poetry photo galleries or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from AP golf writer Doug Ferguson, who claims that golfer Frank Licklider's love of guns almost influenced the naming of his children.
He had twins recently, and the rumor was he was going to name them Smith and Wesson.
Well, it's a good thing he didn't do that, because otherwise little Winchester and Remington Licklider would have had to deal with a lot of ridicule from their schoolmates. Bill Littlefield, thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities, on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.